Okay, so now we are coming to the very final part of the path, the big kind of crescendo, everything building up to the very last aspects of the path, the kind of big breakthrough to becoming an Arya and an Arahant and all these powerful things. So this is now about moving on from right mindfulness to right stillness. Right stillness being Samma Samadhi on the Buddhist path. So let's first of all have a look at the definition here in analysis of right stillness. And what, bhikkhus, is right stillness? Here, bhikkhus, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of samadhi. With the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right stillness. Okay, so this is then the final factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we have gradually seen how you go through this process of purifying yourself, until all the defilements, all the hindrances are completely abandoned. And when they're all gone and disappeared completely, that is when you are ready for this right stillness, as it says here. But there is more, a little bit more to this idea of right stillness than just abandoning the hindrances. Because one of the things that is happening as you move into right stillness is that you're actually abandoning a large part of the reality that you're used to. A large part of reality is completely abandoned beyond your access point. You can't access it anymore. And for that reason, because we are attached to our realities, this is part of what we take to be ourself, right? This is us. And because of that, it is often a degree of fear and kind of also excitement or exhilaration as you move towards this. You're both excited and fearing at the same time, in a sense, because you are here on the threshold of letting go of something which is very close to us and very hard to let go of, for that reason. So there's the five hindrances, but there's also this sense of apprehension. Oh, what's going on here? This is too much. Am I able to let go of all this? And remember, this is one of the reasons why we're talking about Sammata and Vipassana always going together, because to be able to let go of all that, it actually is a large aspect of insight to that, because you have to be able to let go of something. You have to understand that this is not me, this is not mine, right? So at the verge of entering there, there's an aspect of insight that goes with that. And therefore, when you come out of a jhana state afterwards, you see the world in a new way. You have abandoned something that you have never abandoned before. And for that reason, there's always insight that comes with these deep states of samadhi. Again, samatha and vipassana always have to work together, right? When one is strong, the other is stronger. They are two aspects of the same coin, basically. We have to look at a little bit more detail on these things, because it is not immediately obvious what these things mean. So just to have a look at them one more time. Here, bhikkhu is secluded from sensual pleasures. Right? This word sensual pleasures, as I mentioned before, kama in Pali, it means both the aspect of desire and it also means the objects of the senses. It has both meanings at the same time. So here, the main meaning is the objects of the senses. It also includes the the aspect of desire, but that is also included in the next phrase, secluded from unwholesome qualities. So the main thing here is that you are secluded. You no longer have access to the objects of the five senses. You've gone beyond that. This is the main meaning of that. The word karma, when it's used in the plural, almost always refers to the objects of the senses rather than to desire. And here it is plural, sensual pleasures. So you've gone beyond the five senses, right? And that's why this is such a radically different experience from what you normally have. Secluded from unwholesome states. So this is then the five hindrances. Again, you've gone beyond those, and they're again no longer accessible to you, those unwholesome states, which is just as well. The bhikkhu enters upon and dwells in the first jhana, right? The word jhana in the suttas is related to the word jayati, the word jayati, which basically means meditation in the suttas. The Buddha says to the monks, jayata bhikkhave, monks, meditate, right? He uses the word jayata, go to the empty huts. Jayata, it means meditate. So jhana is really one of the main words for meditation in the suttas. But obviously referring to very deep, this is kind of the real stuff in a sense. So he enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination. Vitakka vichara. Now this is, you have to be very careful here what that actually means in this context. And to be able to understand what it means here, you have to read the suttas very broadly to understand how these things are used in different contexts and different ways that the jhanas are looked upon in the suttas. But a couple of guidelines here for understanding what it means in this context. The first guideline is one of the suttas that we looked at earlier on, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thoughts. And you may remember, this is one of the little strange things in that sutta. You start off by overcoming the bad thoughts, right? And then the Buddha says, these thoughts lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, affliction of both. It leads to the cessation of wisdom. It is away from Nibbana. He says all these things. So he said, because of that, I abandoned those unwholesome thoughts. And then I had only wholesome thoughts. But then he said, because of those wholesome thoughts, if I think about those too much, it will tire the mind, right? So I concentrated the mind and entered the jhanas. So in other words, he has abandoned all thoughts, right? Both the wholesome and the unwholesome. And then he enters the first jhana. And they have thought and examination in them, according to this. So thought and examination here has a very different meaning from ordinary thinking. It doesn't actually mean thought and examination as we normally understand it in English at all. It means the very last aspect of vitakka vichara. Once you get to the second jhana, there is no more vitakka vichara at all. It's completely abandoned. So this is the very last vestige of these particular aspects that can exist in your experience. So what it means is a very, very last thing that can be considered a thought. And so what it really means here, and these are the sort of things that you can only really gain access through experience, especially when you experience the second jhana and you look back, that mean the final is a final movement of the mind, right? The mind is just moving a little bit, and that is the most refined aspect of vitakka and vichara. And that is borne out through many other reasons as well in the suttas, that this is how it actually, what it actually means here. You could translate this as, it's accompanied by the movement of the mind. It's a very refined movement of the mind, just moving in a very, very narrow field. It's an automatic movement that pretty much happens by itself. And then you have this rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Seclusion, now the seclusion is now complete. There's no access anymore to the senses, right, or to any unwholesome states. So this is a special kind of happiness that comes as a consequence of that. It's the first jhana happiness of piti and sukha, which has now reached a new height in the first jhana. So that is just a brief explanation of what these amazing states, the jhanas, actually are. Just to have some clarity about what these words mean, because they don't really have the ordinary meaning that we associate with some of these words. And then we go to the second jhana, with a subsiding of thought and examination, again, with a subsiding of the movement of the mind, right? Subsiding of the movement of the mind means the mind becomes completely still. There's no movement anymore. It's utterly and completely fixed. It's like a rock, right? Absolutely like a rock, rock still, solidity. He enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind. So the idea of internal confidence is the same thing as the idea of samadhi. It is internal confidence because you are now fully locked into that object. The reason the mind is wavering in the first jhana is because you haven't got that complete confidence yet. Now you have the complete confidence. It comes from a complete letting go, right? And basically being complete, the object becomes completely stable as a consequence. So the mind is now completely like locked into place. There's no, all the fear, all the apprehension you may have had is completely gone. And you understand that this is something which is to be developed and something to be enjoyed, basically. And unification of mind, this is another way of saying samadhi. The mind is completely, there's no movement there. So the perception you have in the second jhana is one of complete unity. It basically means non-duality, right? This is one of the things of this kind of state. There's no duality anymore. Sometimes you hear this expression, non-duality, being used philosophically in the Vedanta tradition, for example, which is also a tradition where people practice samadhi. This is in the Hindu tradition. So this word non-duality is often used. But here, this is really where non-duality comes in Buddhism. Non-duality starts with the second jhana, and then it persists throughout the higher states after that. Unification of mind can also be called non-duality. And it is without this movement of the mind, without thought and examination, and has the rapture and happiness born of samadhi. So this is another higher state of rapture and happiness. Rapture and happiness born of samadhi. In fact, at this point, we have reached the peak of rapture, of piti. This is the highest kind of piti that can be experienced by anyone, anywhere. If you go beyond this, piti disappears. And this is what happens in the third jhana. And that's why it starts off with the fading away as well of rapture, the fading away of piti. He dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. So the piti fades away, right? And you are left with an even more refined sense of happiness. He dwells equanimous, it says here. So we're now reaching the peak of equanimity. Mind is very stable, very solid. Mindful, it says mindful and clearly comprehending. So the reason, again, why it says that is because we're reaching the peaks of these things, right? It's not just that you are mindful and clearly comprehending. It's that you are really, these things are really growing. They're becoming incredibly powerful at this stage. And this is kind of the understatedness of the suttas. It's a very important thing to be aware of, that the suttas tend to be very understated. If the Buddha says he is happy, it means he is really, really happy, right? He has reached a peak of happiness. Or someone is equanimous, that means they are incredibly equanimous. So this is one way of understanding the idiom of the suttas, that they tend to be, when they state something, it usually means that thing to the highest degree. And this is why what we're seeing here. He experiences happiness with the body, sukkang kayena patisangvedi, or something like that. And again, this is an idiom in the Pali. It is quite clear to me from other places where this with the body it occurs, what it means. It means direct experience, immediate experience. And there are some places where I think that is very clear that this is how this idiom is used, kayena. So you have an immediate or direct experience of happiness is what this actually means. The point here is that the word body, again, has this very broad range of meanings in the Pali language. So you have to pin down the exact meaning in any particular context. So you have the direct experience of happiness, right? Why is that? Because you have left everything else behind. And one of the most important things that you have left behind, as we just saw, is rapture. You know, it's with precisely with the fading away of piti, rapture, that you enter the third jhana. So now only happiness is left. Before you had piti sukha, now you only have sukha. You have kind of distilled pure happiness, as pure as it can possibly come. And that's why it is called a direct experience of happiness rather than mixed with other things. Right? So, and then it says here, again, you will notice the understatement here, right? He enters, dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones, the Aryas, declare. He is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. Right? Here you have reached the peak of happiness that is possible to attain for any being at all, anywhere. And it's just, and he just says he dwells happily, right? So this is what it means to be happy. What it really means to be happy means you enter the third jhana. It is, you know, these are very, again, very, so the highest possible happiness in the world. And then it comes this is the kind of the really thing which is very hard to get beyond that. And then with the abandoning of pleasure and pain. So this is because you abandon all pleasure. Pleasure and pain are two opposite sides of the coin, right? So because they're opposite sides of the coin, when you abandon pleasure fully, this is called somanasa, this is the mental pleasure. Because you abandon that, it's like you abandon the pair of them together. That's why it says abandoning pleasure and pain. It's not as if there is any pain in the third jhana, but it's just that they function as a pair. So when you finally abandon all pleasure, it's like the pair itself has been let go of. And with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, so this was previously in the first jhana where all joy and displeasure happened. That was the piti that disappeared. I think that's what it means here. He enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which has neither painful nor which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. Right? So here you go into a state where there is no pain, there is no pleasure, there's not all those feelings that really all our existence is about. We tend to be driven by pain and pleasure, right? That is what gives rise to craving. All of that has disappeared, and you recognize that actually this is a more pleasant state. The highest, it's more pleasant to be in a state where there's neither pleasure nor happiness than to be in a state which has the highest happiness in the world, which is the third jhana before it. So you move into a space of pure mindfulness, pure equanimity, and this is the highest pleasure that you have ever experienced so far. So those are, in brief, the four jhanas. So these are very, obviously very powerful things. And remember what we're talking about from the very beginning. The idea here on the Buddhist path is that they are supported by the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. They're all coming together. And that is why they're so powerful. And that is why at this point, these jhanas have the ability to make you see things according to reality, because you're starting off with the right view. So now you apply that those jhanas, that power, incredible power of the mind that comes through these things, you apply that to see reality in the right way, or see it in the right way, see reality as it actually is. That's how you apply it at this particular point. So the whole path kind of comes together, right? So this is the power, the incredible power of these states. The things that you see are what we come to next in this sutta. This is from the Fear and Dread Sutta. And this is where Buddha talks about his own final awakening. And this is the kind of things that you see in your final awakening as you are just on the cusp of reaching arahantship or full awakening. Some of the things that you see here, we're going to see just in a second. This is called the Te Vidya, the three higher knowledges. And some of these things are, you know, recollection of past lives, understanding karma and rebirth, a full understanding of suffering. And these things are very hard to take on board, right? It's very difficult to see these things. Difficult in an emotional sense, because you are seeing things that may be incredibly painful and very difficult. And this is why the fourth jhana is a state upon, you base yourself upon the fourth jhana, because you have gone beyond pleasure and pain. It means that you have a distance, a perspective on pleasure and pain. You have gone beyond all that. And it's then more easy for you to remain equanimous while you're seeing things which for most people would be very hard to take and to understand. So able to see this with equanimity. The fourth jhana is therefore the level of incredible stability here, from which you are able to deal with almost anything that kind of comes your way here. So this is why this is so powerful, and this is why one of the names for the fourth jhana is imperturbability. Imperturbable means you cannot be perturbed. Perturbed means that you are kind of affected by things, right? You are affected emotionally in a way. Imperturbable means you're no longer affected by things. You're standing back, just watching it, and just taking in the data, being able to see what's happening here. Okay, so this is how it goes, this final part here of this retreat and of the path. So this is like for most people, this is just kind of knowing what's coming, right? I mean, it's very, very rare for anyone to actually get to these points. But nevertheless, it's very. I find it's very inspiring and interesting to read about these things. When my stilled mind was thus purified, thus refers back to the jhanas, right? The fourth jhana was thus purified. Bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. I directed it to the knowledge of the recollection of past life. I recollected my manifold past lives. That is one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births. Many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. And this is what he saw. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term. And passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term. And passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. So here it starts off with the samadhi, right? You are basing yourself on samadhi. It says here, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, or it could also be translated, when my mind had been thus concentrated or stilled. Sometimes people think that this happens while you are in the jhana states, but this happens afterwards, after you come out, because the jhana states are so still, nothing happens there. So when we're translating, it would be after my mind had been thus stilled, purified, right, bright, powerful, very energetic, unblemished, there's no impurities left, rid of imperfection, malleable and wieldy. And these are kind of some of the crucial words here, that a mind which comes out, the deeper your state of samadhi is, the more malleable the mind is, the more user-friendly it is. It will go anywhere, do anything, because the hindrances, the defilements in the mind are what actually stop the mind from being usable and from moving around very freely. So take those out and the mind becomes incredibly flexible, and it will do anything. All you have to do is just say, go this way, and it will go that way. Go that way, and that's exactly what the mind will do. There's nothing that blocks the mind anymore from searching out or gaining insight or looking at anything, basically. And that is one of the powers of this sort of mind. It is steady and attained to imperturbability. You cannot really be perturbed anymore because you have gone beyond the sort of things that perturb you. You're standing at a higher level, the level of equanimity, and you're looking at the world from that level there. And that is why you are imperturbable at this stage. And then you direct the mind, right, to the knowledge of the recollection of past life. You just say to the mind, okay, let's go into the past and have a look, check it out. And that's what the mind does. It goes into the past and you go backwards. And I think this is kind of the purpose of this sequence here of many, you know, this whole sequence of births, right? You're going backwards, one birth, two births. You start off by going backwards in this life, you know, backwards and backwards. You were a child, and then you may remember things from when you were just a tiny baby, right? And then suddenly you make the leap, and then you are a dying person, perhaps, in the previous life. So it's a gradual thing. It's a process that you're going backwards with. And then backwards from one life to another one. And that might be the reason why it is phrased in this way, with all these births. So you might wonder, what's the point of, you know, having all these births there, is that you're actually going backwards from birth to birth. And sometimes you might make leaps because it's too many births to go through. 100,000 births, after a while you probably get a bit fed up looking at every one. It's hard to imagine getting fed up with this kind of stuff, but that's probably what happens at some stage. And then you also see the really big issues, the kind of cosmic issues, right? World contractions and world expansions. The Pali behind this is vivattati and sangvattati. And basically, you know, calling it world contraction, world expansion, is a bit of an interpretation, because nobody really knows exactly what the Pali words mean. What they really mean is evolution and devolution, right? Or evolution and dissolution. That's what it actually means. So it means a cycle, some kind of cycle where the universe is evolving and then it is kind of dissolving and then evolving again and dissolving. And it is quite possible. I wouldn't be surprised that if this is exactly equivalent to ideas of the Big Bang, you know, I mean, it certainly sounds very, very likely that that's the case. We're talking about vast time spans. So I would, you know, if I were you, I would keep my eyes open and see how physics is evolving in the future. There are certain physicists who are looking at the idea of multiple big bangs and big contractions, and it's possible that that may eventually take over as the, you know, as the favorite theory of physicists on how the universe actually works. Right now, there's lots of, I don't read very much up on this, but sometimes you read about this. Right now, they have all these strange ideas about multiple universes and all these kind of things. But I think, you know, with knowing the Buddha's incredible ability to see things that you would never expect anybody to see, I would not be surprised if this is actually what science comes up with. Perhaps it may never come up with this, but perhaps it will in, you know, next few years, a few decades, or whatever. That would be cool if that came, that sort of came through, right? And then it would just be another. Then it is more clear that this is probably also what is meant in this particular passage. And then you have this view, you actually remember the details of that life. It's not just a flashing picture of a life, it's a detailed understanding of what was going on in that life. You see yourself, right? You know your name, you know your clan, you know your appearance, you know what kind of food you were eating, the kind of pleasure and pain you had, you know how long your life lasted. It's a very full description of that life. It's a full understanding of what was going on. It's not just a picture arising in your mind and then thinking, oh yeah, that must be a past life. No, it's a very clear clarity about actually how you live that life. It's an experience, of a real experience of a life. And remember that when this happens, and this is the feeling when this happens, is like, it's like you're going back there. This is what, you know, what they say this feeling experience is like. It's like actually being there. You go back to these places and you relive those lives. That is what the feeling is like when you're there. So because you're reliving it, it is very, very real when you see these things. It's a bit like sometimes people, you know, sometimes you go into, you have a nice meditation, and sometimes you have some memories during meditation, or perhaps afterwards, memories of from this life, and people, and it's like reliving those memories. It's like you're there again. It's incredibly real. And this is a little bit like that when you remember past lives. So it's incredibly real, and this is why it is very hard. You can't really dismiss it, and the reality of these things is so strong. And then the interesting thing again is then you see how you move from one life to another one, right? So this is how you had, what was your experiences in that life, and then you see yourself passing away from there, getting reappearing elsewhere. You see the continuation, you see the flow of lives, one after the other, and you see how these things move on. And the last thing, of course, very interesting, you see how you passed away from that last life and then reappeared here, which means in this life. So you see the connection of life to life. You see how your personality kind of is changing and how it is conditioned and moving from life to life. You see continuity, right? You see causality. You see how all of this is the person you developed in the past life is the person you have now, and how all of these things kind of hangs together very beautifully here. And this is what the real recollection of a past life is about. It's about that continuity, seeing the causality of one life to the next one, how you develop as a person, and seeing how all this flows on. This is a real, and this is why it is so powerful, because it's just like a memory in this life. How do you know that the memory in this life is real or not? Sometimes people have false memories. It's a phenomenon called cryptonesia, where the memories you build up in your mind are false, right? But you're absolutely convinced that they existed. So how do you find out what is a real memory? Well, usually it has to fit a particular sequence. You remember the whole sequence. It fits together nicely, cause and effect. And this is really how you can ultimately find out whether something is real or not. And this is what we're doing here as well. So you remember that past life with all its particulars and aspects. This is really it, right? This is now we're moving very close towards the Buddha's awakening. This is one of the last things he does before his awakening. So why is it so important? Why is this so important before the awakening? And the answer is that now, for the first time, he's seeing the world as it actually is. He's understanding the bigger picture, right? And that bigger picture is not pretty. It may not be obvious when you read this, you know, you're seeing all these births, but actually, this is what we're talking about before, about understanding things according to right view and rebirth and come up, all this. It actually, when you see that, it is very... you feel very repelled by this because it is a terrible thing, this idea of just going round and round and round, always doing the same kind of mistakes. You go up and you finally find some relief, right? You could have been reborn in a nice place like Perth or whatever, right? And then you go down again, and you kind of, you know, you suffer, and then you get reborn in an even higher place like a Devalok, and then you go down again, right? And then eventually you are just so weary of this. This is just madness. I'm not going anywhere. This is just pointless wandering around and around for absolutely no reason. And this is why I'm saying Buddhism is the purpose of life. It's a teaching which has to do with the very meaning of life, because it takes you out of that purposeless wandering around. From the perspective of one life, everything seems so meaningful and purposeful. But from the perspective of seeing the bigger picture, all meaning loses all its meaning. The meaning is kind of, it doesn't exist anymore. It just disappears. And then you understand that there is only one solution to this, and that is getting out of this. But before you come to that solution, the second thing that the Buddha has to understand is the mechanism that drives rebirth. Because once you understand the mechanism, then you understand also whether it's possible perhaps to go to one particular rebirth and hang out there forever, right? Or how this works. The mechanism is important. And once you understand the mechanism, then you can perhaps make a more clear decision about what you should be doing with yourself. But before that, this is what the Buddha then says, right, about this insight. He says this was the first true knowledge, right, attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. Right? This is a true knowledge. This is true insight. This is a real understanding. This is one of the three. It is here, and the three are past lives, recollection of past lives, understanding the laws of karma, and then eventually making the final breakthrough, understanding the Four Noble Truths, and then becoming an arahant. So this is one of those, right? So understanding of past lives is this absolutely central. This is like what the meaning of real knowledge is from a Buddhist point of view. Ignorance was banished, right? This is what ignorance is, not understanding rebirth, not seeing it. That is ignorance. So from a Buddhist point of view, if people who say that there is no rebirth, basically it is just a matter of ignorance, of being conditioned into the wrong view. But the real ignorance is only really banished when you see it for yourself. True knowledge arose, darkness was banished, right? You've been in the dark all this time, you didn't really see. And now, for the first time, you see, somebody turns on the light, and you see, wow, this is what it's like. Now I understand, it's actually pretty bad, actually. So I got, this is what happens when the light gets turned on and you see things as they actually are. And this is what happens in one who abides heedful, energetic, and resolute, right? So if you are really heedful, if you're really energetic, that is what you can expect to happen ultimately. And as I said, I think last year here as well, when I we're talking about this, this is only one of the similes that is used. There are other similes as well. And one of the most powerful ones that I like is the idea, the Buddha says, it's like a chick breaking out of the eggshell, right? The little chick sitting inside the eggshell. And eventually after living in there for, I don't know how long it takes for chicks to hatch, but you know, whatever it is, sitting in this little world, enclosed in this eggshell. And one day, you use your claws and your beak to kind of get yourself out of this shell. And in exactly the same way, and then of course, what the world you see when you come out of the eggshell is just, wow, this is what the world is like, right? You've been enclosed in this little thing for so long. Now you see the world for the first time, and it's just, whoa, it is so much bigger. It is so much vaster. Instead of seeing this tiny little life now, you see this enormous thing expanding out in front of you, into the past, into the future. And everything just looks so incredibly different from what it did before. Just like it does for that little chick hatching from the egg. So, we come to the second of these vijjas, these true knowledges that arise. When my mind had been thus constant, thus stilled, was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw being passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. Thus, these worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, reviler of the noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of the noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their action, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. So this is the kind of big view karma, the big view, not the karma in this life, but the karma that kind of rules samsara, rules our experiences. Our experiences are conditioned by our karma. So again, you use this powerful mind attained through the four jhanas, and now you direct it to the passing away and reappearance of beings. So again, you just tell the mind, okay, check this out. And with a divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, this means the kind of the eye of the mind, right? Not the physical eye, but the eye of the mind, the kind of eye that you have in deep meditation, where you're still possible, you can still see things, but you're actually seeing things with the mind rather than with the physical eye. And then that's where you see these things happening. You see beings passing away and reappearing. You're seeing the process of death and rebirth, right? And you're seeing how people have all these different faculties, the different kind of destinations. Fortunate and unfortunate is the translation of sugata and dugata. Sugata, dugata means literally well gone and badly gone. In other words, gone to a good place and gone to a bad place. So happy and unhappy, fortunate, unfortunate. And then he understood, he sees the connection between the actions in one life and the rebirth in the future one. So these are the actions that are lead to bad rebirth, right? Bad conduct in body, speech, and mind. And especially being a reviler of the noble ones, right? So when somebody is very pure, the kamma is more powerful for people who act in regard to such people. Wrong in their views and giving effect to wrong views in their actions. And these things go together. If you really have wrong view, then you also will give effect to those wrong views. If you don't give effect to the wrong views, it means that there's some other view which is holding you back, right? It's not that you haven't actually taken that view on board fully. But once you take on board a view fully, that there's no problem in living an immoral life or whatever because it doesn't have any repercussions or whatever, if you take that fully on board, then it is natural that you will act accordingly. And that is why these views, when they become strong, are so problematic. As a consequence of all that, after death, you reappear in an unhappy place, a place of suffering. Then the opposite of that is the idea that beings who are well-conducted, and the exact opposite, not reviler of the noble ones, right in the views, giving effect to right view in their actions, these people or these beings are, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappearing in a good destination, even in a heavenly world. So this is the mechanism of kamma. This is how beings kind of fare along. And what you realize is that there's no stability in this, right? We're always creating new kamma. We're always doing new things. Every kamma has a limited potential. It means you only, even if you do a lot of good, you only are reborn in a good destination for a limited period of time because of the limited potential of that action. And all of this is part of what you see here. And the thing which is scary, the thing which you start to see, is that really there is no direction to this whole thing, right? There's nobody inside. If there was somebody inside, I think at this point the Buddha is starting to see. He's not actually the Buddha yet, he's the Buddha to be. At this point he's starting to see that there is no self here directing this process. If there was a self, then surely that self would direct this process in such a way that you always do good, right? So you can always be happy. But the fact that you don't always do good, the fact that you are conditioned so powerfully by the experiences around you, that sometimes you do bad, sometimes you do good. And this becomes very clear if you remember a vast number of past lives and you can see how random it is whether you do good or bad. It becomes very clear that there is no director to this orchestra. There's nobody behind this controlling this whole thing. There is no self, right? This is one of the things that I think is becoming clear at this point. It is just happening according to a vast network of cause and conditions. And there's no In the final analysis, there's nobody standing at the steering wheel, steering this ship in any particular direction. It's just drifting according to the prevailing winds. That's all it is. And that, of course, again, is it is an eye-opener, right? Whoa, this whole thing is really concerning. You know that in the future, unless you get off this wheel, you will have to experience tremendous suffering again in the future. As if there isn't enough problems already, you will experience even more problems in the future because of this thing which just kind of, you just move around almost randomly from life to life. So again, very powerful and very important to understand that mechanism which drives rebirth, the understanding that as long as you stay in samsara, you will have to experience all of these things. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides heedful, energetic, and resolute. So now that he has seen the problem, he is ready to make that final penetration into reality, to see reality as it actually is. And this is the final and third truth, real knowledge that we come to at the very end here. So when my mind had been thus stilled and was purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is, this is suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the origin of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, these are the taints. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the origin of the taints. I directly knew according to reality, this is the cessation of the taints. I directly knew according to reality, this is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. So here, he is now becoming the Buddha at this point, and he's directing the mind to the cessation of the taints. These are the asavas, and these are the kind of the most deep-rooted, if you like, defilements in a human being. The taints usually are said the taints of the kamasava, the taint of sensuality or sensual desires. The bhavasava, the taint of existence, in other words, the taint of being attached to existence or desiring existence. And the avijasava, the taint of ignorance, of not seeing things. So this is obviously what's happening here. The taint of ignorance is gradually being destroyed, right? You're starting to see samsara for what it is, experience for what it is, life for what it actually is. And here, at this point, he is ready to make that the ending of it all, because he understands he doesn't really have any attachment to existence anymore. Once you see, understand samsara, he has already given up the attachment to karma, right? So that's the kamasava, the taint or the defilement of the sensuality. That's already been given up through the jhana process. Now, by seeing things as they actually are, he's also giving up the taint of existence. He understands that existence is futile. It's just painful without any kind of goal or purpose. It is a purposeless thing. So that is also given up. And now the only thing which remains is the taint of ignorance. He hasn't fully seen this yet. The taint of ignorance itself is becoming very, very weak at this point. So getting very close to making that final breakthrough. And at that point, because he is trying to understand all these phenomena as they actually are, he's able then to penetrate the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering, right? The experience is suffering, is basically what he's seeing. And he has understood that this is driven by craving. This is probably in part the experience you have when you see, understand what we have just been looking at. The cessation of suffering, the ending of craving, and finally also the path. So here you have that direct insight into the Four Noble Truths that we discussed at the very beginning here. And because of that, so you are basically, you're seeing reality, you're seeing the three characteristics, and you're seeing how that applies to the five khandhas. All of this is just different ways of looking at this kind of insight. So the three characteristics apply to the five khandhas is basically you understand that your experience is always subject to impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And then you have this alternative way of expressing the Four Noble Truths. These are the taints, right? These are the defilements, basically. And he knew as it, according to reality, this is the origin of the taints. And that is ignorance is basically the origin of these defilements. You have defilements because you are ignorant. And the strange thing here is that one of the defilements we're talking about is ignorance itself, right? So ignorance is the cause of ignorance. So if you're ignorant, that creates more ignorance in the future. Ignorance traps you. You are blind, and blindness leads to more blindness. So ignorance is actually the cause of ignorance. So this is one of the things that he sees here, the origin of the taints. And then he sees, according to reality, the cessation of these defilements. And that is the cessation of ignorance itself. And then he also understands the path, which is the path that we have been looking at now all the way through, the Noble Eightfold Path. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of existence, and from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge. It is liberated. I knew directly, birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So this is then what happens. When you see all of that, then your mind becomes liberated. Sometimes the first part there is the stream entry experience, and then the second part, which I just read now, is the Arahant experience. In the case of the Buddha, it seemed to happen all pretty much together. So when you see all that, when you understand all that, then that leads to the destruction of all the defilements. The defilements can no longer exist at that point. So because of that, and one of the consequences of that is that you know that you have been liberated. You know that your mind has become liberated, right? It's not something, it's not just, have I done this or not? You are aware that final liberation has happened. And what you know, and this is again, this idea, the question was the other day that maybe the idea of rebirth has been added to the Buddhist teachings later on. But again, what do you know? What is the thing that you know when you become an arahant? What is the whole purpose of arahantship? This is what comes now, right? I directly knew birth is ended. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Right? So the thing that the arahant knows, well, he knows that he has taken the path to the end, but that, okay, fair enough. But the real knowledge here, the one thing which is special, which stands out, is that he knows that rebirth has come to an end. There's no more coming to any state of being. That is the one knowledge which stands out here. And this is always the case, and sometimes it's worded in different ways, right? Which means that it's not just a standard statement, but it is slightly different wording. And this is the knowledge of arahantship. No more rebirth, no more a future experience after I pass away from this. This is equivalent, of course, to the ending of suffering itself. So that is arahantship. And it is a little bit difficult to grasp exactly what it means, of course. That is kind of the little bit of a mystery of these things, but you kind of get an idea where all of this is heading and what this is all about. Okay. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides heedful, energetic, and resolute. Right, so this is the third and final knowledge. Now you have attained full awakening. Each one of these can be considered a partial awakening, but the full awakening only happens when you attain all three of them and you see all three. That's when you become a Samma, Sambuddha, perfectly awakened one. And one of the interesting things here is that each one of these three, they are almost put on the same level, right? Each one of them is like a breaking out, hatching from the shell. Each one is a turning on of the light, a dispelling of darkness. Each one of them is considered a true knowledge. So it means that all of these things are actually tremendously important. But it's only the final one that leads to the irreversible breaking out. Once you have attained this, you can't go back anymore. Ignorance has been banished, and there is no more of this for the future. So there's no, it's irreversible. That's basically what this is saying here. And you know that it is irreversible. So you have, that's it. You have attained the highest happiness. There is nothing more to be done. And then, as it says in the suttas elsewhere, it says that then you become like the workman waiting for his wages, right? This is what Venerable Sariputta, who is supposed to have said, that Venerable Sariputta was the Buddha's right-hand man. And the Buddha said that if anyone is to keep on rolling the wheel of the Dhamma in the world, it is Venerable Sariputta. So he was almost on the same level as the Buddha. They're both kind of rolling this wheel. And that's what he said. Now I have attained the final awakening. Nothing more to be done. Just have to hang out till I get my wages, right? And the wages is when you die. It's weird, isn't it? It's the exact opposite of ordinary life. When you die, it's like, oh no. For him, it's like, oh bliss, finally I'm dying. Getting out of here, right? That shows you how reversed everything becomes. And this is why one of those favorite sayings, and this is from the Dhammapada, I think, what the ordinary person thinks is happiness, the Arya knows is suffering. What the ordinary person thinks is suffering, the Arya knows is happiness. And that's where that comes from. And then we have the very last one, which is a tiny little extract from a sutta. This is a sutta called in the Sanyutta Nikaya 2284. There's only one line, so it's a very short extract. But this sutta is about this monk called Tissa, and he's not doing all that well, and he's kind of a bit depressed, and he's lost his way on the spiritual path. And then one of the monks takes him, come Tissa, I'll take you to the Buddha, and he will get you back on the right track again. So the Buddha gives him this long teaching about restraining your senses and about doing the right thing, and then you will be okay again. And then at the end of that, and this is this whole thing about the Buddha, he's there to help us attain what is beneficial, to help us attain happiness, right? And then he says at the end, and this is so powerful, he says, "Rejoice, Tissa, rejoice, Tissa. I am here to exhort. I am here to assist. I am here to instruct." And this instruction, of course, is precisely the instruction that leads to everyone's happiness and well-being. And that is why it is worthwhile rejoicing in these very powerful words of the Buddha himself. Okay, that's it. So. Okay, so that is the end of it all. I am going to skip the guided meditation because we haven't done quite a number of guided meditations already. And I find it's not so easy after an hour's teaching to guide a meditation properly. So I hope you will forgive me for skipping that. But before we end today's thing, maybe just once more, thanks to Bianca. Is Bianca here? Bianca, are you here? No, she's always away. Okay, anyway, a last thanks for everyone for all your kindness and all the things. It's always nice to go on these retreats. For myself, I always find that the atmosphere is very good and people are always very helpful and very kind. What a wonderful thing that is. So before we close off, maybe we should pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Might be a nice thing to finish off in that way. So let's do the standard closing homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.